I'm back after an episode on Pakistan, which is the first pod of the year, but recorded in 2020. And so far, 2021, not looking spectacular, except for Georgia. So, every once in a while, everyone gets what they want. And in this case, in the case of doing a pod on Cambodia, I got everything I wanted. Because the reason why Cambodia came up in my news was because the BBC did an article about a woman who did a documentary about a man from Cambodia who's known as the Donut King. And could anything be better for me, a lover of donuts, than the donut being the tie to the country? Fairness? It's not a Cambodian donut. The donuts happened here in America, but it was Cambodian. He became the Donut King. Seems like the dream country. So, before we dive in to Cambodia, where it's at, its history, what we need to know besides the Donut King, which feels hard to wrap my mind that there could be something besides the fact that the Donut King, singular title, is from Cambodia. But besides that, we'll be back after a brief word from our sponsors. It's Citizen Cork, where we used to say no country was more or less important than any other country, and we used a random generator. But it's a new show. We now source from countries in the news to help you get to relevant information faster. So, Citizen Cork, where no country is more or less important than another country. You're just in or not in the news.
And so before we dive in, we're going to have a word from our sponsor, because it is sort of fun to get paid some amount of money for this, and we'll be back after that.
All right, we're back, and it's Cambodia. And this is a country where I've gotten oh so close. Cambodia borders Vietnam, Laos, Thailand, and the Gulf of Thailand. And having gone to Vietnam, I've gotten really close to Cambodia. It's a lot closer than, say, I've been to Pakistan. So I'm excited to do this. I'm also, besides the Donut King situation, excited because Cambodia comes up a lot in Asian art history courses. And if you were an Asian studies person like me, then you've seen a lot of pictures of Cambodia, both old ancient temple sites and Cambodian art. And so it's nice to actually finally learn something. It's admittedly not well understood. But so let's go back to where is Cambodia. So China, really massive, right? If you found China, follow the coast of China down, long skinny country on the water following China down, that's Vietnam. Go to the left, the map has north at the top, and there's this tiny little, like almost rectangular country between Vietnam and then another large country. That large country is Thailand. The country in between the two is Cambodia, and Laos is the tall, skinny country above Cambodia. So Cambodia is interesting in the sense that, like its neighbors of Vietnam and Laos, you cannot fly directly there. But that has more to do probably with air traffic. Unlike Laos and Vietnam, which for the longest time, you couldn't do direct flights because they are communist countries. And God knows, if you flew directly to a communist country, you might just think communism was for you. You'd bring that contagion back to the US, and then where would we be? But so, that is not the case. You can get there in about one day. It takes a stop. But the good news is, flights are cheap right now. Like every other country, right now is a great time to visit because real, real, real low cost. I'll just take anyone. All right, so Cambodia has a coastline, largely though has land borders. And now, if I were describing the shape of Cambodia, like as I looked at it on the map, what I really felt was that if you kind of turn your head a little, so you cock your head to the left, Cambodia actually sort of looks like a jellyfish that has just flared out. No tentacles at the bottom, right? Like it doesn't, it ends kind of, but it's almost like a, you know how jellyfish move? It's almost like a jellyfish has just moved out and is about to contract back in for its next propulsion. That is what I would say Cambodia looks like. So, you know, the next time you're looking at a map, turn your head a little to the left and see if you can find the jellyfish country. Cambodia is no different from so many of the countries we cover in that its formation comes at the hands of Europe. But what's really interesting is just how much Cambodia mirrors Nigeria in terms of the instability between independence and now. So in 1863, Cambodia becomes a protectorate, just feels rich because I'm sure France wasn't going to help them, of French colonial rule. Like, it's good while it's good. I hope nothing goes bad. Because, say this, because in 1941, Cambodia becomes occupied by the Japanese and remains occupied by the Japanese throughout the duration of World War II. Because when the time comes, France won't be there. I can't wait to do France again. That'll be a good pod. Come back around, talk about all of its colonial issues. Maybe do a France part too. So Japanese occupation ends, and then, because this is rich to me, France reimposes its protectorate. Okay, we weren't there when you needed us. Don't worry, we're back. However, what's interesting is there's a constitution now in place that allows for the forming of political parties in Cambodia, which of course can only spell the end. So it's kind of strange that France shows up at all. And so in 1953, Cambodia wins its independence from France under its king, Sihanouk, and it becomes the Kingdom of Cambodia. And this man, King Sihanouk, lives until 2012. So we're going to come back to all of this because there's so much rich history. But basically, the borders have been largely set since the middle of the 1800s, confirmed in the 1900s. And then, frankly, it's just war and violence for a lot of different reasons. You have a lot of outside countries coming in throughout the second half of the 20th century. So, before we go there, let's pause and get a sense of the size of the country, its people, and its capital. So, Cambodia, the jellyfish nation, is home to about 16.25 million people. And this is a super, super small number for this part of Asia. To put this in perspective, Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam, just a couple hundred miles away, has almost that many people in just the city. Cambodia, a shockingly small population. We'll get into reasons why potentially it's smaller than its neighbors. Cambodia has one of the prettiest flags I've ever seen. And what's really interesting is that this flag, which is a blue stripe and a red stripe and a blue stripe with a depiction of the temple Angkor Wat right in the middle of it, black and white depiction of Angkor Wat, and it's sort of like an outline sketch. I just find its simplicity while celebrating one of its country's most well-known, most beautiful historic sites is really interesting. But what's really fascinating is that it is the only flag in the world that incorporates an actual building, not a suggestion of a building, not like the silhouette of a mosque. Cambodia is the only flag that has an actual identifiable building depicted on it. The red and blue are traditional Cambodian colors. And the way it works is that the two blue stripes, which are top and bottom, equal in total the width of the center red stripe. So blue, red, inside the red is the black and white Angkor Wat temple. I'll kind of describe that temple later on because it's part of natural wonders and unique history of Cambodia. And then that blue stripe at the bottom. So Cambodia, 16.25 million people. And its capital, which is spelt P-H-N-O-M-P-E-N-H, two words, is pronounced Phnom Penh, according to multiple internet sites. Specifically went to videos of Cambodians speaking instead of some weird site called Emily Says or Emma Says. Yeah, gotta stop trusting that one. So, as according to people from there, it is pronounced Phnom Penh. Phnom Penh is home to just over 2 million. So to put this in the perspective of, you know, cities and states, the whole country, that's 16.25 million people, is somewhere between the state of Pennsylvania and the state of New York. Pretty much split the difference, which is interesting because it's not very helpful. We don't have anything that's very similar. So the city aggregation, if you were to think of like how many cities would I need to combine, is actually pretty spectacular. It's the top five cities in America, basically, would get you New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Houston, and Phoenix. The combination of those would get you to 16.25, maybe a little bit more. Now, in terms of the size, though, of where that 16.25 lives, the 16.25 is spread out over, and if it were a square, it would be 264 miles aside on the square. State-wise, it's pretty close to North Dakota, which means nothing to almost everybody because there just aren't any people in North Dakota. But it's tough because there really isn't another state that's a great fit for size. A little bit smaller, North Dakota's a little bit smaller. Missouri becomes your next most common, a little bit smaller, and then Oklahoma. All of those states are pretty close in size and they're all just slightly smaller than Cambodia. So hopefully Missouri rings some bells. It doesn't have any poetic description. I can give it like a jellyfish about to retract from propulsion. That is basically the nicest thing I'm going to say about Missouri for a while. So, good thing this isn't about America. Disaster. So, staying focused. Cambodia. Also, kind of a history of disaster. It's hard to put GDP for these places around the world into perspective. But for Cambodia, they have a GDP of 64 billion. Maybe if we're lucky, it's up to 65 billion just now. Right, the estimate to today. So, and its GDP per capita, even across that low population, is $4,000. To put this in perspective, that's less than 1/10 of the United States GDP on a per capita basis. That's tough. The US is its number one trading partner. The US dwarfs its second trading partner, which is the UK, by more than double. What's really interesting is that for a country very close to China, it has a very low exports to China, right? But imports from China are incredibly high. 34% of its imports are from China, which is really interesting. What happens in a lot of the neighboring countries there is that they export a lot to China in raw materials. China then refines and then exports those on to other countries. So the export ratio to China is typically a little higher. Then to also put this in perspective, its neighboring country of Vietnam has a population of 100 million people and yet has a GDP per capita of 6,900 or almost 100% more, 4K to 7K, so 75% more. This is a huge difference in wealth. And there's a huge difference in what the last 60 years, 50 years in each of those countries have looked like. To put it in perspective, the export to China and import to China in Vietnam is basically they export half of what they import from China versus Cambodia, which has about a 1-5 split. Really different dynamic with its largest general region player. So what's interesting about Cambodia from a people's perspective, and we'll get to this, is that the Khmer, which is the leading ethnicity, is 97.6%. The next is a Chan people, 1.2%. Then everybody else is negligible. And we'll get through this history. But that is a hyper, hyper mono ethnic country. There are very few countries with such unbelievable lack of ethnic group populations, especially a country with such long history in such a dynamic part of the world in terms of movement of populations historically. All of its surrounding neighbors, while having a predominant ethnic group, have a number of minority ethnic groups, a lot of ethnic groups. Vietnam has over 50. So we'll get into all that because that's basically the big part of the story with Cambodia. In terms of its industries, it's got largely tourism. It's got some amount of garment and then agriculture. And it is one of the poorest countries in Asia. This is not a wealthy continent. Wealthier than Africa, but not wealthy. And so it's quite a situation for them. There are two big stories. There's the ancient story of Cambodia, which the Cambodians are, the Khmer, are very passionate about. By the way, Khmer is the language as well. And the people are very proud of their long ago history, the long ago history that produced the Temple of Angkor Wat. And so we'll cover that off. Then Cambodia is really known for its contemporary history, the scheme of the history of the earth. We're talking about the last 60 years. Since independence, Cambodia has had an incredibly volatile, violent history. And we'll cover that off. And then a little bit about what Cambodia is doing right now. So as a positive thought, let's explore Cambodia's past. It's far, far away past. So this is the first pod recording in the new year. Cambodia is a country where it's really important to think about the borders, because the borders weren't really particularly well defined, in that since the 12th century, there has been known conflict. Let's assume there was conflict before the 12th century. 12th century CE, there has been conflict between Cambodia and Vietnam and a extension and retraction of the border there. And this is particularly important because what happens is a really strange geopolitical alignment that ultimately comes out of this area in Asia. And we'll get into that. So it's interesting about Angkor Wat in Cambodia and its importance now and its importance historically is that Angkor Wat was actually a Hindu temple in its first origin. And as Hindus lost the empire that stretched through India, through the coast of Thailand, into Cambodia, retraction, Buddhism came from the east. And it came through and also eventually came through from the west. But some of the original pressure comes through by way of China and Vietnam, and what we call China and Vietnam today. And then some of the Buddhist, original Buddhist alignment, which would have come out of India, also eventually makes it here. But based on art history, it seems to mostly come from Vietnam and China. And so these Hindu temples become Buddhist temples. And today they're Buddhist temples. But that's not always been the case. And obviously, I think once you know that Cambodia has a communist history, which we're going to get into, there is no religion in communism. So they have a space that is non-religious as well. And what's interesting about the Hindu origin moving into Buddhist origin is there is actually one leader of Cambodia that is Muslim in the whole of Cambodia's history, which means that over the course of Cambodia's history, they've had three of the major world religions as their religion: Hinduism, It's a major world religion, though people feel that there are two types of major world religions, in which case two out of the three religions here have failed to meet the standard. And that is the idea of conversion, right? So some people feel that if you're not trying to convert people, Hindus aren't, you're born into it. Buddhists aren't inherently either trying to solicit new followers, though much more possible in Buddhism than it is in Hinduism, then you're not quite the same kind of situation as Islam, right? So in that way, no. But in terms of major religions, and I think it's important to remember that outside of the US, outside of Europe, Christianity has pockets in South America. It has pockets where the colonial empires extended to. It has pockets in Africa. It continues to have some incredibly strong ties in certain countries in Africa. But there is a much larger percent of the world's population in Islam and Buddhism and Hinduism. These are massive religions. And so to have had a country go through, even though they had just the one ruler for Islam, go through one Muslim leader, to have a country go through three major religions in the course of its history is quite remarkable. To put this in perspective, you really have only forms of Christianity as the evolution in Europe, right? We'll go whole debate on exactly the pre-Jesus, post-Jesus Christianity versus Judaism. But altogether, you really had very little in the way of like religious diversity in Europe. We have religious diversity in the US now, though I can't say we do a great job on tolerance in this country, and we have to realize that we are a minority. Maybe work on being better. It's hard to record this after January 6th because it's hard to ignore just how intolerant so many Americans are. So to stay focused, the idea here would be, can you imagine if the US were to become a country that didn't say God, but instead said another God's name, right? If we instead had Vishnu or we had Allah, would we have kind of the same culture as we do now? And the reality is we wouldn't, right? So much of our founding fathers' framework and other things are deeply set in their religious beliefs. And yes, some Quakerism in there, and so it's a slight deviation, but all trace an origin to the same branch. And so I think it's a country that has had very distinct chunks of time that are very distinctly different from the prior times. It's not, say, an evolution. It's not Confucianism sits next to Buddhism, is both in existence. These are religions that were pushed out by the next one that came in. And that's always like an underlying tension, always. So to speed things up a little bit here in the history, right, is Charles, pick up from here. So to speed things up a little bit in the retelling of this history and to get to what is a critical understanding is to come out of World War II, the US, and not many others are on a vehemently opposed to communism, right? We immediately move basically into the Korean War. People argue that it's not immediate. We are a nation that likes to be at war. Whether or not we want to accept that as a reality is neither here nor there. But after World War II, American interventionism and its look around interventionism drastically changes. We become a much more interventionist country. And in the case of our fear of the spread of communism, which has to be the most unfounded fear of all the fears we as a nation have ever had that have caused us to go out and kill other people, has got to be that somehow communism was really going to work, and people here would really want it because of how nice it looked everywhere else. And that's because while I think the ideas behind communism and socialism can have some appeal in a absent of reality context, the reality is people do not want to give up what they have. And so there's not a lot of fear, because there are always going to be people who feel that they had something to lose. So between when the pre, kind of like, let's call it the Western is not, Western powers between France and the United States are not in the Cambodia Vietnamese region, Vietnam had actually overtaken Cambodia, and Cambodia was a protectorate of Vietnam. And so then the French come in, they get under French colonial rule, they gain their independence in the 1950s, and Vietnam gets their independence from France, and suddenly though now there is communism in the region, right? This ties into Korean War era. Communism seems to be spreading down the coast, and here it is, it's coming. And so from 1955 to 1975, and obviously the extent of it, the size of it, and the awareness in the United States follows a different timeline. However, it's critical to understand they had barely received colonial freedom. The Vietnam War starts right following the Korean War, and we are determined to hold ground. And so the alignment of the countries, though, is actually Cambodia with North Vietnam, not South Vietnam, and South Vietnam was, let's call it, more aligned with the U.S. No one really liked anybody, and I don't blame them. But so by 1964, we have a quarter of a million soldiers in South Vietnam, and we are in full-blown Vietnam War situation. And so you have Cambodia has this uneasy relationship at this point with the North Vietnamese, because they don't really want to be in an alliance with the Vietnamese because of their history. They really don't want the US. And part of this is because we had a secret bombing campaign as part of the Vietnam War, where we dumped 500,000 tons of bombs on Cambodia, which is 3-ish times more than what we dropped on Japan in World War II. Think about that. You don't know about it. It's not regularly taught. We know about it now. Information has come out about this. Classified documents were released, stolen and released. And we all know this now, or we can all know this now. But Cambodia finds itself in this uneasy alliance. Ultimately, the US bombing campaign ends, the US presence in Vietnam ends, and that's the 1973, the bombing campaign ends, 1975, we're gone. That war is beyond lost. And I don't know what we were trying to win, but that's neither here nor there. I'm not afraid of communism, the whole principle of I'll wait till it looks like something I want. So now the US is gone, and there's not the same compelling force for Cambodia and Vietnam, any part of Vietnam, which is now all of Vietnam, but any part of Vietnam and Cambodia to be allies. It doesn't have that same force. And so what actually happens is a situation where the powers in Vietnam and the powers in Cambodia begin to splinter and become just separate from each other. So on the sidelines of all of that, there is actually a different US relationship brewing in Cambodia, despite the fact that our bombing continues into 1973, we had started to form an alliance with a faction of people, leaders, a party in Cambodia. And so prior to the 1970s, Cambodia had a hereditary leader, as in they had a king. And so the first step for the person we're about to talk about, Pol Pot, is ultimately the overthrow of the king. So first step first is to depose the king. So while their prince, Norodom Sihanouk, was out of the country, he was leading at that point, the Khmer Rouge and this communist party, communist in quotes party, throws a military coup. The prince comes back and decides to align himself with the Khmer Rouge and a general that had overthrown, right? Yeah, the military general who had just executed the military coup actually receives the backing of the United States. And so out breaks a terrible number of deaths and violence. Mass atrocities is how it is framed, without numbers known. And simultaneous to all of this infighting in Cambodia and this realignment of some of Cambodia now aligned with the United States, is that the US and South Vietnamese soldiers have entered Cambodia to try and find the Viet Cong, or North Vietnamese, who are believed to be hiding out in the forest jungles of Cambodia. So this whole, we're bombing them, we have our own soldiers in Cambodia searching for Viet Cong and Viet Cong aligned groups, and simultaneously we have another faction supporting the military leader who overthrew the government, while that government, the hereditary prince, has aligned himself with the party that's going to come out on top, which is the Khmer Rouge. And so we're entering the middle of the 1970s. Hopefully everyone's following this little dance we all did where no one wanted the US around, the US was terrible, and then because there was a factious split inside the country, there's a part of Cambodia now aligned with the US, part of Cambodia aligned with the Vietnamese. So neither faction is particularly happy with their bedfellows. And so the Vietnam War ends, the US leave, and Cambodia and Vietnam go back to having a border. And so then, just as a reminder, the part of Cambodia and Vietnam that align is South Vietnam, right? So they meet at the water, and so while a good portion of the border goes pretty far up in Vietnam, and that's how they were able to connect their northern portion with Vietnam's northern portion, the skirmishes that are about to break out on the southern part of the border. And so in the 1978, the end of 1978, actually Christmas Day, 1978, the Khmer Rouge and the Communist Party of Cambodia, which was then the Communist Party of Kampuchea, which had become the Republic, Kampuchean Revolutionary Army. It's a democratic Kampuchea, which was not so democratic, and they're controlled by the communists. So Cambodia, controlled by the communists, is now fighting on the southern border with Vietnam, because we're back to our hereditary feelings about our neighbors. And the feeling here is that they are trying to regain land they had lost over the centuries in all of their conflicts and had not been settled before the French colonial rule. Now French colonial rule had interrupted them figuring out their borders, and here we are. And so what starts is an immensely long war. And part of how the situation plays out is with the rise of Pol Pot. So all this time, Pol Pot, who, that's not actually his birth name in case anyone cares, but it is how everyone refers to him. So Pol Pot has been throughout all this time brewing and helping to form the Cambodian Communist Party. And so he basically sits around in the background. He's a force throughout the 1950s, 1960s, well, late half of the 50s, early 60s. He reorganizes the party in 1960, gets himself some power, and then rises to the top of his party just in time for this offensive into Vietnam. So he doesn't officially get into a position, a top position of power, until 1976, after the prince, who had chosen to align himself with the communists, thinking that was a better option, is forced to resign. And that is what happens with uneasy alliances. Doesn't work out. So 1976, they've just started the offensive into Vietnam, and this offensive is going to keep going. So Pol Pot, like all good communist leaders, was actually born into wealth. He was born in French Cambodia and goes to school in Paris and has a very nice life. And when you think about that and what comes next, it's always interesting, because so much of who he was a massive lie. And so he comes back with a Marxist-Leninist look at communism, and has been now building up his power in his party. He's now formally in charge of Cambodia. And in 3 years' time, 1976, 1977, 1978, he will go on, as he goes to cement power, it becomes a one political party country. And as he goes to cement power, he kills somewhere between 1.5 million to 2 million Cambodians. And so while Cambodia's population has grown significantly over time, there is no doubt that both the loss of the 1.5 million, even if it's on the lower end of the spectrum, plays a role in the population today, because not only are they not alive, the children they would have had or grandchildren they would have had are not alive because they didn't get to live. And so there is an unbelievable continuation of that impact in terms of the whole country. But so 1.5 million to 2 million out of a population of around 7 million, then, this is not minor. This is brutal cleaning house. They basically went after anyone who had been powerful before, anyone who's well-educated, anyone in the arts, anyone who's religious, anyone who might be insurrectionist to them, and they're cleaning house. The expression killing fields comes from the mass graves during Pol Pot's regime. That is just the idea that the fields were so large, filled with so many who were brutally murdered by Pol Pot or his cronies, since of course someone like Pol Pot would never actually get his hands dirty. He is responsible for one of the most horrific genocides ever. And so he has now gutted this country. However, because of picking the fights with Vietnam at the border, he ends his time in power much earlier than potentially would have happened, because he basically needles Vietnam until Vietnam amasses 60,000 troops, comes over with both the troops and air support, and marches into Cambodia and deposes of him, and he goes into exile and he goes hiding. So he's beat back. However, that doesn't last. And so by the end of the 1970s, his army, his forces, the Khmer Rouge forces, are coming back in. They have aligned themselves with China. They receive military support from China in terms of like materials, guns, all the kind of weaponry they have. And he basically pushes in with a sort of reformed military in the early 1980s, because this 10-year war does not end quite so easily, despite the advance that makes it look like it's all over. So basically, he wants to regain some sort of popularism. Remember, he's already killed 1.5 million people, but he believes that if he wins the war against Vietnam, he'll be back in power. And so he continues to work on trying to find a way to move in. and come back into power. And so with this alliance with China, Pol Pot goes to Beijing, there's a conference, and this part all gets super complicated, but basically the prince who had run out of the country, he's still alive, he's been up in Pyongyang, which is by Beijing, in the scheme of the world, they're very close by, relative to the view of, like, say, Beijing to Cambodia, much further. So they're all in Beijing. The government there has some players trying to organize this whole thing, and somehow they decide what would be best is for the prince to go back and have a coalition government, and that will include the prince and those loyal there and their little military group. It'll include Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge and that military group, and it will include another man, Sun Sen, to kind of build out this whole coalition. What happens there is Pol Pot begins to realize he's not going to be able to get all of the support to ultimately take back over this coalition government, and he actually dissolves his Communist Party and stands up a new nationalist party, because nothing says good times ahead like the rise of nationalism. And so they get together, they have a new form, he's ditched, let's say, what he considers to be the dead weight, and he believes that he's modified the party enough to get popular, which is a hilarious idea. I don't know how you could be so insane as to think like that's ever going to happen. You killed so many people. But like, he genuinely believed the end of collective eating, which was this idea like everyone gets the same amount, and the ban on individual possessions being lifted would somehow endear him. And he feels like this is all going to work out and this is going to launch him, and so this all feels good, except for that he ends up diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, and he moves his base right outside of Cambodia and into Thailand, because he basically has to kind of regather himself. This is 1985. We're coming to the end of the Vietnam-Cambodia War. And this happens because he's resigned now, being commander-in-chief. He's turned it over to Sun Sen. And he still, of course, has influence, but is not where he was. He actually leaves Cambodia to go get treatment for Hodgkin's disease for the last 3 years there, and basically comes back in 1988, but otherwise he's gone for 3 years, and the world moves on without him. A negotiation is reached, the war with Vietnam ends, and you have today's borders affixed between Cambodia and Vietnam. However, the push for control doesn't end. China still plays a major part. They are not holding what's called real elections. And so the Khmer Rouge are continuing violence, and they are continuing to be anti-Vietnam. And so Vietnamese settlers are like being massacred. It's not improving just because Pol Pot's gone. And so you have this period of time between the technical end of the war and truly a change in leadership, which does not happen for a very long time. So Pol Pot stays in power either indirectly or directly. Basically now from the 1988, he returns healthy to Cambodia and stays in power until 1998. So in about his final 3 years, Pol Pot, like all great dictators, becomes really paranoid, please understand people. I'm obviously being facetious. He was a terrible human being. Yet to learn about a good dictator. So the standard being he becomes immensely paranoid, which very interesting enough was Stalin's whole thing, being immensely paranoid. And so he starts ordering the killings of leaders underneath him, which basically ultimately sinks that whole party. And so party, warring faction, whatever you want to call them. It's hard to, there wasn't a real ideology anymore, so I don't want to call them a party. And so the group there basically ends up dissolved because they have so much infighting. It's all not great. And Pol Pot himself actually dies in 1998. His paranoia, of course, led his own party to turn on him because, hey, they were tired of dying. What would you know? And they actually imprison him in their own base. And so he is technically out of power. Though, of course, when you're alive and a dictator, are you ever really out of power? It's hard to tell. It's unclear just how much continued power manipulation he held while not being in charge of this group. So the Khmer Rouge sentenced Pol Pot to life imprisonment in 1997. And basically 1 year into this, Pol Pot dies in his sleep from a heart attack. However, there are those who believe that he was murdered. And I'm okay if that's the answer. I might feel better about it. Sometimes it's hard not to see bad things happen to bad people. So that was a very long way around to say there's a colonial situation. It looks like there's going to be independence, but because of century-old conflict between Vietnam and Cambodia, there's a power struggle between the two nations. It continues. The Vietnam War kicks off shortly after their independence because we're afraid of communism here in the US. The alignment basically is a faction of Cambodia is aligned with Vietnam, a faction of Cambodia ends up aligning with the US, and ultimately China becomes a player in this whole situation and has a faction that becomes aligned with Cambodia. They ultimately become the power brokers for Cambodia and stand up this coalition government and conceptually elections. And they don't get rid of Pol Pot for decades. And he is the leader of one of the most horrific genocides in world history, but he doesn't live long enough to be tried for his crimes. And that would basically summarize it. Since 1998, the question is, what's been happening in Cambodia from a government perspective? And what's incredible is Cambodia chooses to return to a monarchy. I mean, it's a bit of the UK monarchy, but they return to a monarchy. And the man who took over as prime minister after Pol Pot in 1992, Sen, is the longest ruling prime minister in any perspective. Right? Putin comes out of the 1990s. This guy's been in power since 1982, when he becomes the official prime minister. So you have a prime minister, there's no real elections, and you have a monarchy, which is the monarchy line that had been overthrown, then realigned with the Khmer Rouge, and ultimately somehow comes back into being. And so that is Cambodia. It is not a place of free and fair democratic elections. It does not make it out of despot ruling. There's really continued blood on the hands of all of these people who have stayed in power after using their power to kill millions. Trying to come up with happy news here, and it's tough. But what's interesting is Cambodia continues to have a tie to China. However, their prime minister is taking COVID as a time to show that they have a spine against China, and they are not going to buy the Chinese vaccine for COVID, which has to be, I think, one of the most interesting ways to say no to China. In happy news, to try and turn this podcast somewhere else, slightly lighter, it's hard, was the resettlement of the, quote, world loneliest elephant, end quote, and none other than Cher was there to help accompany him from his release from zoo in Islamabad, Pakistan, into Cambodia. And now, I know we're all thinking about this, but somehow I've managed to make Pakistan, Cambodia come full circle. Maybe that's the happy ending. We're back next time with St. Lucia in an amazing interview with Marinka Thompson-Oldham. Be well and never give up on America's democracy. Till next time.